From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Coming up this hour, author James Carroll looks out on a world in crisis and the lessons of Constantine's sword. We begin with the latest news from the Middle East, where stunning violence has marked the first night of Passover. A suicide bomber today killed at least 19 people and injured more than 120 at a hotel in northern Israel, where families had gathered for a traditional Passover meal. Lee Hockstetter is Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. Earlier, I asked about reaction to this latest bombing.
Well, it might be worth remembering that probably a lot of Israelis don't know about this yet. Certainly Israeli religious Jews wouldn't have the media tuned in on Passover night. And maybe even a lot of secular Jews treat Passover night as a time that's purely for the family, not for phone calls, not for television, and may not even have discovered it. But that said, it is certainly going to have an incendiary effect here, at the very least. And I think it's fair to say that a very harsh military response from the Israeli armed forces will be forthcoming in a matter of hours or certainly in a day or two.
So you expect Israeli retaliation. Does that mean we're headed back into the cauldron of full-throttle violence by both sides?
I'm afraid so. I hate to sound like Chicken Little and say that the sky is always falling here, but in fact, if one looks at the last 18 months of violence in the Middle East, there's a very consistent pattern. It can be graphed. It's so consistent. And that is of gradual and consistent escalation with peaks and brief lulls in between those peaks. And each peak, each terrible cataclysm, each terrible spasm of violence has always managed to be somewhat worse than the last. And that pattern has not been broken, and it's probably fair to predict that it will hold.
And how will this terrible bombing play into the regional political moment? Arab leaders have been gathered in Beirut. There's been talk of a new peace initiative. How is the chemistry likely to be changed there?
This event has certainly overshadowed what has been a somewhat disastrous summit of the Arab League in Beirut. The Arab League was televised throughout the Arab world, throughout the world today as squabbling over the order in which leaders would speak, specifically the order in which Yasser Arafat would give a live satellite address. And this sort of petty dispute has now been overshadowed, to say the least, by an absolutely deadly, brutal attack in which at least 16 people have died, well over 100 have been injured, and many of the dead and injured, I believe, are children, women, the elderly. Passover, as you know, is a family holiday for Jews the world over, secular and religious Jews. And so this has had an especially bloody effect and will receive, I think, a very emotional reaction from the Israeli public.
Such a bloody effect because families had gathered at the coastal town of Netanya in this hotel to observe Passover.
Yeah, they were just sitting down to their Passover Seder, which is the feast that commemorates the Israelites' exodus from Egypt, mm-hmm. Biblical exodus. And as a result of the fact that they were seated, most of them, many, many of the injuries are to the chest and head.
Was the bomber actually in the dining room, the lobby? What were the logistics?
It seems that he walked into the lobby with possibly with a suitcase, although the accounts are somewhat confused, and was spotted by the female receptionist who said, "May I help you?" or "What are you doing here?" At which point he ran into the dining room, which I think is just adjacent to the lobby, and within a number of seconds blew up. There were something like 250 people in the dining room, and so this was really a killing field.
What were the official Israeli responses to today's attack?
Well, Shimon Peres said that whoever had carried out this, what he called despicable attack, have entirely lost their humanity.
And as for Yasser Arafat, any comment on his responsibility? That tends to be something that comes up when the Israeli spokespeople come forward after attacks.
There are reports that he telephoned Anthony Zini, who is the American special envoy, who's been here trying to negotiate a ceasefire. These are unconfirmed reports. I think what's unconfirmed is exactly what Arafat said. Probably it's fair to say that he condemned it, probably fair to say that he wasn't responsible for it. These are the unconfirmed reports. There are some indication that he may have made some sort of a pledge to arrest those responsible from the military wings of some of the militant Islamic groups, possibly from his own Fatah faction. But as I say, those are unconfirmed, and I'm just not sure yet.
Lee Hockstetter, where does this leave hopes for some kind of solution? Or, on the other hand, more in tune with what you've been saying, if we're headed toward another plateau, another escalation of violence, what is next? It seemed pretty bad only 2 weeks ago before it settled down slightly.
Like any military, the Israeli military is always planning for the next step, always planning for the next battle. And there has been active military planning going on for quite a while here for the next step, which would be perhaps not dissimilar from the last step, but more intense. In other words, more of the same, but deeper, broader attacks on Palestinian towns, cities, refugee camps. Again, I don't like to predict, but there are many analysts here who, in the Israeli press and the Israeli media, for example, and Israeli officials themselves, who will tell you, speaking privately, that it's perfectly reasonable to assume that within days or weeks, the very most a month or two, we're going to see another, as you say, plateau of violence. It's really the sort of internal dynamic of the thing. Lacking any outside force, either diplomatic or political or military, that has the power and the potency on the ground to interrupt the momentum that this conflict has generated by itself, there's simply nothing that's going to stop it. The conflict has its own logic, its own dynamic, its own momentum, and there's simply no force strong enough to stop it. The American diplomatic effort here is simply inadequate at this time.
Does either side think that through force it can physically solve the problem, or is this a mutual effort, a contest by each side to break the spirit of the other side?
Well, I think it's both. I think both sides have somehow maneuvered themselves into thinking that that only by force can the other side be made to see the light, that only by force can the other side's will be bent, and that each side will slowly but surely be weakened by the pain and suffering and bloodshed and death that each side can inflict on the other. This is the internal logic of this conflict.
Lee, I guess the last thing, if this is then going to resume the kind of forest fire dynamic of violence, at what point does it burn itself out?
I wish I knew.
Lee Hockstetter is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. This year's Passover and the Holy Week holidays find Christians, Jews, and Muslims locked in an ominous dance of suspicion, retribution, and violence. It was just a year ago that our guest tonight, James Carroll, led Christians to re-examine their church's long history of anti-Semitism in his best-selling book, Constantine's Sword. Today, three religions intertwine in a war on terror, a war in the Holy Land, and battles even within themselves. James Carroll is a reverent, angry, yet optimistic Catholic, an ex-priest and a weekly contributor to the Boston Globe, who writes on the very issues that now weigh heavily on the hearts and minds of thinking Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Tonight, we're taking a look at the lessons of Constantine's Sword and asking how and if they apply to the crises of the past year, the crises of now. What are our responsibilities to history, to reality, to our children in the conflicts that now swirl? What do we need to take from history to move forward toward atonement and forgiveness? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Good evening and welcome, James Carroll.
Thank you, Tom.
It's awfully good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you. James Carroll, you wrote such a big book a year ago. It made such an impression on so many people, looking at the history of two religions, of Christianity and Judaism, and in particular looking at the long, deep history of anti-Semitism within Christianity and the roots of that, the implications of that over time, and something about the way out of that old trap as well. We're going to impose on you tonight to take some of the learning that you did in the process of putting that 750-page book together to open your scope a little wider for us, and we know you do this all the time in your wonderful columns in the Boston Globe, to see if we can't take some of the lessons that you drew out of that long story and apply them now to this wider picture where we're not only two but now three religions are in some kind of dance here. I wanted to start with this question. You wrote that about a warning from the philosopher Nietzsche. You said Nietzsche warned that if we stare into the abyss, it may stare back.
in the last 6-7 months, I think a lot of us have felt that we've been staring into some kind of abyss.
Yes.
And there is a kind of magnetic power when you stare into that abyss. In this case, the abyss Americans felt opened up by the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and everything that was torn open by that. What was the danger that Nietzsche was warning about staring into that abyss?
Well, it's a powerful image with which to begin, Tom. I'd say, what is an abyss? An abyss is a pit of darkness. And the challenge of an abyss to a human being is to define the darkness. No one tells us what we see when we look into that hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe absolutely that the definition of the abyss comes from what we project into it. When we looked into the abyss, and that's a powerful image for what happened in this country last
mm-hmm.
fall,
mm-hmm.
we defined it in a way that has had drastic consequences. There are two phrases that I would lift up from our early definition, us and them, us or them,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is dead or alive. And I discovered in the work I did on the history of Christian anti-Semitism this simple lesson, that once Christians began to define their relationship to Jews as a relationship of us or them, inexorably, sooner or later, and alas, too often it was sooner, the relationship moved into a relationship of dead or alive. In other words, when you define yourself positively over against someone else negatively, you've set yourself on a track toward violence. The tragedy of what happened tonight in Israel is, in my opinion, in direct consequence of the radical escalation of violence in the world that began when the United States of America chose to define its crisis last September and October in radically violent terms. War is no solution. It's so palpable in Israel tonight. And yet, what's happening in Israel tonight is very much tied to decisions that we've been making in our country this year.
You know well about the power of words, James Carroll, words delivered particularly in hot moments, in raw moments. Of course, that phrase, dead or alive, was President George Bush's phrase. It was explicitly, specifically aimed at Osama bin Laden. It said, we want this single man, Osama bin Laden, dead or alive. But you're suggesting, in the way that words often can, that it speaks to a larger relationship. Fill in the mural for us.
Well, the impulse of dead or alive sets events in motion that soon outrun the ability of anyone to control them.
But you're saying it's not just one man?
No,
obviously
what happened last fall was we did accept President Bush's agenda with Osama bin Laden,
mm-hmm.
and he did talk about it as if we were in the Old West. But notice what happened, Tom. We set in motion a war that, in fact, has killed, we don't know how many people, hundreds, thousands, perhaps. We're not sure who was killed. It's not even clear to us that significant leaders of al-Qaeda have been killed. None have been captured that we know of. Osama bin Laden, who was the epitome of the agenda when we said dead or alive, mm-hmm. is not only gone, he's off our agenda. When reporters ask Secretary Rumsfeld and President Bush for, a revisiting to the profound agenda we set in motion last fall mm-hmm. about Osama, the response now from Washington is he doesn't matter so much. Let me just jump back and say this is not unrelated to the 2,000-year-long history of Christian anti-Semitism. Holy Week is a time when Christians remember the story of Jesus that was told by the second generation of his followers
mm-hmm.
as a story of us or them over against Jews. And it was not true. It was a result of contingent historical consequences, but the effect of it was to set in motion a definition of Jews as the enemy. And once they are the radical ontological enemy, violent impulses are set in motion.
We're talking with James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword, an exhaustive history and personal reflection on anti-Semitism in the Christian Church. We're looking tonight to see what lessons can we draw in an era of larger conflict, not just two religions now, but three, perhaps descending into some kind of abyss. We hope not. We're looking for a way out with James Carroll. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword. That, a year ago, came out as an exhaustive history and personal reflection on the long history of anti-Semitism in the Christian Church. In the process of unearthing and bringing to our contemporary eye that history, James Carroll thought a lot about the interaction of cultures, of religions, how words and wounds can last and motivate over centuries. You can join our conversation tonight. The question is, perhaps, what are the moral lessons most vital to confronting the world's crises today? What subtexts are at work here? What lessons from history show the way toward peace? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. James Carroll, you were talking just before the break about Holy Week and what you call the blasphemy of Holy Week. It's sort of the cornerstone or the starting point for your entire exploration of anti-Semitism within Christianity. Remind us of that blasphemy and describe how its ripples then went out across centuries.
Well, the blasphemy was a result of contingent historical circumstances intended by no one, but it was that followers of Jesus defined the story of Jesus as a story of Jesus against his own people, of Jesus against the Jewish people. The Jews are defined by the followers of Jesus not only as the enemy of Jesus, but as the enemy of God. We see that explicitly asserted in the Gospel of John. This week, throughout the Christian world, the Passion narratives are going to be reverently read, are being reverently read. And once again, we are hearing a story in which the Romans are exonerated for the death of Jesus and Jews are blamed for it. It's complicated, Tom, to explain exactly how these texts came into being. It's important to remember that Jesus died in 30. The gospel texts are composed, finally, between 80 and 100. And in that two-generational period, what basically happened was two groups of Jews began to argue with each other over what it is to be a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
In the aftermath of the destruction of the temple. What is it to be a Jew without the temple?
And in the context of imperial subjugation and everything else.
And in the context of a massive Roman war against the Jewish people, mm-hmm. in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Probably the most savage violence against the Jewish people until the 20th century. In that crisis, a profound trauma, two groups of Jews begin to argue over what it is to be Jewish, and that argument becomes polemical, heated, and the record of that argument is the Gospels. Actually, the Gospels, as scholars remind us, is one side of the record. We hear the Christian side of the argument. And what happened was those Christians remembered the story of Jesus through the lens of their own problem, which was a problem with their fellow Jews who denied what they were believing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they told the story of Jesus against Jews.
And the consequence of that misinterpretation?
And the consequence of that misinterpretation is, especially then when Gentiles come into the church and begin to dominate it, they don't remember that Jesus was a Jew himself. So that the Christian church quickly begins to define itself over against the Jewish people, who then become living embodiments of the devil. And once that theological structure is put in the Christian mind, violence is an almost inevitable consequence. All of that is still alive for us in Holy Week. We are revisiting these texts tonight, and we have to remember where they come from, and we have to remember that in this one fundamental way, they're profoundly wrong.
So there, as you define it, is the structure at the heart of a millennia-long conflict.
Two millennia, actually.
Millennia, I guess.
Latin professor
we'll
would say.
We'll take them both, in this case, in their horror. It may even be a kind of a template for how unending conflicts, fights unfold. We don't want to push the parallel too far here, but we are looking at a world that sadly seems to be in bitter camps right now, and there is a strong religious cast to these camps. Are we caught up now in new historical misinterpretations in your mind that are driving a new conflict or these new conflicts?
Well, there is the ancient human impulse to divide the world between us and them that seems to be basic to us as creatures. I would say that there's something else at work in the present time, which is very hopeful. which is that human beings actually are confronting this dynamic and are trying to do something about it. And again, coming back to the Christian-Jewish story, one of the most powerful events of our generation has been the way in which, in very formal and explicit ways, Roman Catholicism and other Christian denominations have formally renounced the gospel affirmation that the Jews killed Jesus. That was a serious declaration of the Second Vatican Council in 1965. It was a movement away from this Christian structure of mind that necessarily sees Jews as the enemy. The reason that's important is it offers us an image of religious reconciliation. And if Jews and Christians can turn this corner, can rediscover each other with mutuality and respect, then I would say so can Jews and Muslims, so can Christians and Muslims, because frankly, the enmity between other groups, other religions, pales by comparison to the traditional contempt for Jews that has been manifested by Christianity.
James Carroll, how do you see religion playing out in the conflicts currently afoot, that is, in the war on terror? In the way that intersects with what's going on in Israel, bring the Islamic world into this equation for us.
Well, religion broadly defined and religion narrowly defined. Religion narrowly defined, we all know what that is. Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism,
so
Buddhism. So and in India last week, the conflict between Hindus and Muslims is a reminder that this is a worldwide phenomenon. Religious fascism is what you might call it, and it is alive and well. It's been alive and well in recent years in my own Ireland. Religious fascists are still, in some ways, moving to undo the peace process in Ireland.
How do you see that at work in the Islamic conflict, in the conflict
it's
sparked by 9/11?
It's when the us against them impulse is sanctified as a work of God. And when you believe that God has affirmed you and condemned them, then we've moved into a whole new level of danger. You see that radically now in the ways in which Jews are once again being demonized by Muslims out of what we Christians must recognize as the old gutter bigotries, surfacing only in recent weeks, the old blood libel, the proclamation that Jews in their religious services are murdering and killing children. Mm. The old blood libel, the old anti-Semitic definitions of Jews as the enemy of God. When that begins to happen, something intractable, as it were, in the people.
Let me ask you this. You've written in this month that you've said Israel's dilemma is a foretaste of America's. What do you mean?
Well, when Israel begins to respond to the threat of terrorism with the myth of overwhelming force, that we can overrun this threat and we can impose a solution and respond to every escalation with a further escalation of our own, I'm afraid we see the pit into which this kind of violence brings us. And my own strong conviction is that the United States of America is on the same track. It's war on terrorism, open-ended, reinforcing the worst impulses of our government, and I would say sanctified by God again. The United States of America is not an explicitly religious country, but it's powerfully implicitly a religious country. Mm. And all of this God is on our side assumption in the United States of America makes this impulse truly dangerous.
We're talking with James Carroll, columnist, author of Constantine Sword, winner of the National Book Award for An American Requiem, about the intersection of history, of religion, and of conflict. Conflict's very much alive right now, today, this evening. You're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Hiawatha is on the line. Welcome, Hiawatha. You're on the air.
Yeah, I work at the Boston Globe. I'm a columnist at the Boston Globe, and I nearly lost control of my car listening to this nonsense.
Hiawatha Braid, welcome. You're on the air. What do you have to say?
Oh, can you hear me?
Can hear you loud and clear.
Good. Just checking. I mean, I'm just astonished here. Now, the first thing that I heard out of Mr. Carroll's mouth is the fact that because we decided to fight back against somebody who murdered 3,000 Americans, it is now officially our fault that a bunch of Palestinian fanatics just murdered 16 Jews. This is a level of denial of reality that boggles the mind. These people, not all of them, but a substantial thread in Islam, hates Jews and wants to wipe them out. Don't you keep up on current events?
Hiawatha, I hope you pull over. Hiawatha, pull over and stay with us. James Carroll.
Well, I don't appreciate having my positions and statements so radically mischaracterized. I believe that the Palestinian bomber who killed the people in Israel tonight is fully and entirely responsible for that act. There is no way in which the United States shares responsibility for that heinous crime that was committed tonight.
So how is it that we set the process in motion?
On the other hand,
into a case of us versus them. That's rubbish.
Let me say that the events unfolding in the Middle East, and I would also say in India and Pakistan today, are not happening in a vacuum. There is a world movement of a return to violence, a return to radical demonization of the enemy that is unprecedented since the end of the Cold War. And if you don't recognize that, Mr. Bray, if you don't understand its relationship to the present crisis in the Middle East, then you're not paying attention. I'm sorry.
I recognize it perfectly well. What I'm recognizing is that we're not the ones causing it.
Hiawatha Bray, may I ask you, can you take a second? May I ask you, I guess James Carroll's analysis does go towards self-reflection. Where does your analysis take you in terms of a prescription?
I don't know what the prescription is, but I do know this. We've got to start with understanding the disease. I'm sitting here trying to imagine somebody in 1939 sitting around and talking about how, well, gee, I wonder what the Jews did to make the Nazis so mad. Who cares? They're Nazis. That's all you need to know. In this case, we know for a fact. I mean, if you read our paper, the one you write for, you know that these people publish books and manuals talking about how it is their job to wipe out Jews wherever they find them. We didn't make them think that way. They already think that way.
Hiawatha Bray, I want to thank you for your call and for your passion. And we know that after the death of so many Americans, James Carroll, there are many people who share precisely this view or some variation on it.
Well, it's,
you can hear the heat.
Yes, of course. And the heat is completely understandable. But what has happened in the last 6 months, or as Lee Hockstetter framed it, the last 18 months, certainly, is that marginal voices in the Palestinian movement, which are intensely inhuman, fascist, they have embraced a cult of suicide, which is a blasphemy to everything that human life represents. They have moved from the margin more and more and more toward the center of Palestinian impulses. Why has that happened? It isn't only because Palestinian people, as a people, are wicked. Indeed, the Palestinian people, like the Israeli people, overwhelmingly approved the peace process, overwhelmingly looked for negotiated compromises, and overwhelmingly expected something other than the situation we've come to tonight. How did we come to this, then? It's because the marginal extremists have been licensed, and they have been licensed by a broad, extreme response in the larger world. And I would include in that response the response of the United States of America last fall, when we defined our response to the tragedy and crime of September 11th as a response of war-making instead of law enforcement, as a response of demonizing and instead of capturing the criminals who were responsible for it.
Could one not make the case that this violence was licensed by the attack of September 11th?
Well, it's true. It's true. And which is why the attack of September 11th must be denounced by every human being. It must be condemned in every way we can think to condemn it. The basic problem, of course, is that we responded to it, an act of savage violence, by, again, embracing a strategy based on violence. I believe there was an alternative. That's water over the dam, and maybe we don't want to get into this tonight.
Is there still an alternative?
Yes, of course there's still an alternative.
And what is it in your mind?
Well, let's take the Middle East, the intractable problem. The Israelis must not be condemned to be the ones who are the only ones capable of solving the Palestinian problem. Obviously, what has to happen is a massive intervention from outside that conflict so that the Palestinian problem, which is overwhelmingly a problem of poverty, disenfranchisement, dispossession, and exile, that problem must be resolved by people outside the context, outside the conflict. The United States government, when it defined the world as us or them last fall, also completely renounced its responsibility to look for nonviolent solutions to this overwhelming human problem of the Palestinians.
But there is no massive intervention possible for the global situation we're looking at. We don't expect Martian intervention.
No, that's true. But there are things that can be done. We've seen them in history. We saw what the Marshall Plan did after the devastations of World War II in Europe. A Marshall Plan for the Palestinians, totally appropriate. Coming from the United States, absolutely.
Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Good evening.
First-time caller. I love the show.
Thank you. Good to have you, Mike.
I'd like to ask your guest if he has reflected on it, to give his opinion in a kind of comparison and contrast sense of the Hindu-Muslim conflict happening in Asia versus the Judeo-Christian-Muslim conflict that's happening in this hemisphere.
We got it, Mike. Thank you. James Carroll.
Well, I'm far from an expert on either Hinduism or Islam. What I recognize, especially in the escalations of violence in the last several weeks in India between Hindus and Muslims, is the savage consequences of people who feel licensed to define their enemies as devils and who feel blessed by God to behave in inhuman ways. My mentor, if I can call him that, not personal but academic, Hans Küng, the Swiss Roman Catholic theologian, once said this kind of motto of his: there will be no peace among nations without peace among the religions. There will be no peace among the religions without dialogue between the religions. And there will be no dialogue between the religions without fundamental reexamination of basic assumptions. Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, all of us, secular people as well, we have an obligation to look at our basic assumptions. What are our ideas, our policies, our ideologies, and our theologies leading to in the world? The reason this is a relevant question for Holy Week is Christians are doing this work. Our theologies have led to drastic crimes against Jews. We are reexamining those theologies. This is an example of what every religious group and every religious person must do in the world today.
But this label of devil is being thrown about in so many directions now. It was the United States labeled the great Satan in fundamentalist Islamic marches that we've seen throughout the Middle East.
There are consequences. Once you define your enemy as evil and yourself as virtuous, you are licensed to do as you will. And that is what the United States has been doing. We have lost our credibility, and that's one of the reasons we are marginal to the crisis in the Middle East today.
And not only the United States. What to do in a world where everybody is labeling everybody else the devil? James Carroll has written, "This is the way the very earth could move to self-destruction." Join our conversation tonight. What are the moral lessons most vital to confronting the world's crisis today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword, a full telling of the history of anti-Semitism in the Christian Church. Tonight we're talking about a three-way dance, the intertwining braid of religions, of hatreds at work in the conflict, in the conflicts plaguing the world today, plaguing the world tonight, the first night of Passover, on a night that saw terrible violence renewed in Israel. What do you think? How can we avoid reenacting ancient cycles of hate and misunderstanding? What can we learn from the long history of Christians and Jews that illuminates the world's burning conflicts today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jackie is on the line. Welcome, Jackie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity.
Good to have
you. It's refreshing to hear some historical aspects to decades-old conflicts in the world. And I wish the media would give more of historical backdrops to current events instead of just saying what happened today.
Mm-hmm.
Israeli occupation for more than 20 years of Palestine has brought what has happened today. What happened to us in 9/11 was because of U.S. arrogance, U.S. support for dictatorship, for military rules. And I just, if there is a message today, tonight, it is to learn history and stop repeating all the mistakes by really putting perhaps the responsibility on the media and people like Mr. Carroll to say, this is the history, let's learn from it. Let's not just blame people, and let's please stop calling people anti-Semites, because Arabs are Semites. Jews are Semites. So are many other people.
We take your point, but we think we know what it means, and we take your big cheer for knowing history, and we thank you for your call, Jackie. I want to take that and put it to James Carroll. In conflicts that become cemented in mythology and in blood debts, blood libels, blood feuds, how does history get manipulated, James Carroll?
Well, Faulkner had this great line, the past isn't dead, it isn't even past. I mean, it's clear, nowhere more clear than in the Middle East, that we're constantly revisiting the past. I'd have to say quickly in response to the caller, I agree with the main point she's making, although even there, to cite the Israeli occupation as the source of the problem here, let's remember that the occupation is a result of aggressive wars launched by Arab nations against Israel. And also let's remember that no one has been more vigorously opposed to the Israeli occupations of the territories, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, than a large segment of the population of Israel itself. We mustn't fall into the trap of talking about Israel or the Palestinians, for that matter, in these sweeping, categorical, moralistic terms. Hiawatha Bray just, as I heard it, called a whole people Nazis, which is an absolute offense. The Palestinian people are not Nazis. There are fascists among them who have come to power in this recent period. It's important to understand that the peace process, which has been a major source of hope in the Middle East for almost a decade now, was owned by the majority of peoples on both sides, and they are still there. And I believe that, I think that we have to keep that uppermost in mind. Mm. Second point, though, is that the ancient impulse to scapegoat Jews, to understand, to shortcut and short-circuit political conflict by falling back on contempt for Jews is alive and well in this conflict. There is clear, evident, powerful, and driving anti-Jewish contempt coming from all parts of the Arab world right now. It's very dangerous. And I would say there's an upsurge of anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism, whatever you want to call it, hatred of Jews, demonizing of Jews, scapegoating of Jews that you see in Europe today, too. This is a serious problem. We have to be aware of it. It's part of the story right now.
What about anti-Islamic sentiment? What about anti-Christian sentiment? Do you see them as comparable factors or of a different order?
Anti-Islamic sentiment is also one of the important pieces of this story. The Christian church, I would say, is we have special reflecting to do here. We have firmly renounced contempt for Jews and violence against Jews. We have never firmly renounced violence against Islam. The Crusades, Crusaders attacked Jews, the church apologized. Crusaders attacked Islam, the church never apologized for that. The way in which the West itself has defined itself, us against them, over against Islam, is one of the structures of the mind that's at work in this history right now. So absolutely, that's a part of the story too.
I want to pick up on something else Jackie said. She's talking about history not only in the way mythology can travel the history, but in an ignorance of history or a willful blindness to history. And we all know what she means. You can feel it in a nightly news program sometimes, at least in the United States, and I'm sure elsewhere. This is what happened in this instant, divorced from the history that came before it. You've written, James Carroll, that you see, that you fear the United States becoming a new Sparta, that is, a nation prone toward militarization. Now, there's a big school of thought out there that says, yes, and by God, we're going to build that military so that we can deal with real problems in the world. And we've heard some of that sentiment here tonight. You've got a different view on it. We want to explore that view. One of the things that you see leading to an American propensity toward militarism right now is American time. Tell us about that one and the others.
American time. Well, we define ourselves by the future. Other nations, other peoples define themselves by the past. You can become an American. All you have to do is come here, and you're an American. You can't become a Frenchman, Tom. I mean, you may know people who've lived in France to the second and third generation, and they're still not French.
Ask the Algerians.
Yes, exactly. We are a people of the future. It's, in a way, the greatest thing about us. But it means that we're very, very careless about the past.
But you've said this is part of how Americans have, to quote you, have reinvented ourselves as the most belligerent people on Earth. How does that sense of time relate?
Well, here's an example. The Cold War ended. How did that happen? In the American story that has taken hold of our public imagination, we won the Cold War. We have almost entirely ignored the fact that the Soviet Empire was dismantled from within by a massive act of nonviolent resistance launched by an unknown electrician by the name of Lech Walesa and then followed over 20 years by a whole slew of brave and unknown people.
No credit to Ronald Reagan, tear down that wall, the imposing
American
military.
Well, it's a dynamic process, mm-hmm. Of course. None of these things happen in a vacuum. But Mikhail Gorbachev had choices to make, and he chose at every point against violence, against war, and the Soviet people did as well. In other words, for us to remember the Cold War as an American victory already set something in motion. How much better would the world be right now if we all had a fuller sense that the end of the Cold War was a victory for nonviolence? It was a victory for people who believed in the possibility of overthrowing a totalitarian system without recourse to war.
You want to make Lech Walesa the poster child, a nuclear arsenal.
Well, in shorthand, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The greatest event of the 20th century was that the Soviet Empire was overthrown nonviolently. Now, if we had a vivid sense of that memory, we would be less inclined to try to go around the world solving problems with war.
And there's a history lesson. Oh, there's so much I want to get to, but the callers deserve to come in. Arthur is on the line. Welcome, Arthur. You're on the air. Hello. Arthur. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. You're on.
I like so much of what James Carroll says, but I wanted to comment on one thing that I don't agree with him on that
Please.
He said at the beginning of the show. When he talks about the Gospels being anti-Jewish, I don't think he's right. It's the Gospel of John, for example, clearly distinguishes between the chief priests, the Pharisees, and the rulers who wanted to kill Jesus, the very small minority, the authorities, and the common people who loved Jesus. In fact, it says over and over again, the only reason they didn't kill Jesus sooner, that is the authorities, was because of the common Jew who loved Jesus.
Arthur, we've got your point. I'm going to give it straight to James Carroll. Thanks for calling.
It's a good point, Arthur, but I disagree with you. John is explicit in defining the story of Jesus. As John puts it, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. The drama of the story of Jesus in John is a story of a man who was rejected by his own people, which is fiction. Jesus was a Jew, a faithful, observant Jew to the day he died. He was devoted to Israel, and he preached nothing but the God of Israel. The Christian memory emphasizes it in an entirely different way, so much so that within a couple of generations, it was even forgotten that Jesus was a Jew. And Christians ever since then have thought of Jesus as the first Christian.
And you see no divide between Pharisees and common Jews of the time?
Well, Pharisees are cast as villains in the piece.
Certainly are.
And,
in the Gospels.
Yes. And that's instructive because there are assertions made about the Pharisees in the Gospels that are completely unhistorical. The Pharisees are hypocrites. They're concerned only with the letter of the law, not the substance of the law. They're obsessed with the observance of the Sabbath.
You're saying this is historical revisionism.
Well, I'm saying that the characterizations in the Christian imagination are wrong. When Jesus put the value of human life above the law of the Sabbath, he was doing it as a Jew in the context of the Jewish tradition. That was not anti-Jewish. And the Gospels remember that as a kind of anti-Jewish blasphemy, and that's not true.
Arthur, there's more here than we can fully resolve, but I want to bring in Stella from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Good evening. Welcome, Stella.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to share with you a passage from the writings of Baha'u'llah. Regard the world as the human body, which, though at its creation whole and perfect, hath been afflicted through various causes with grave disorders and maladies. That which God hath ordained as the sovereign remedy and mightiest instrument for the healing of the world is the union of all its peoples in one universal cause, one common faith.
Stella, put it in layman's language. What do you take away from that?
What I take away from this is that the job that the world has been charged, that we, humanity, have been charged with at this point in our evolution and our spiritual growth is to recognize and to grow into the truth
Union.
Of the truth of that the world is one country and mankind is its citizens.
Stella, we seem awfully far from that tonight, don't we?
We do seem far from it in one respect, in that we are unlearning, we are seeing our old ways of thinking and our old ways of operating disintegrating around us at an increasingly rapid pace. Along with that is growing, just as this program is demonstrating, is growing the awareness and the of the urgency and the absolute need of uniting as one family.
Stella, I'm so glad for your call, and thank you for making it to us tonight. James Carroll, she used a phrase, we are unlearning. Is it as bad as that?
Well,
are we regressing?
We have to unlearn some things, Tom. It's a good word. We have to unlearn what we think of religion. We think of religion as the thing that sets us apart from other people of different religions. Another way to put the beautiful statement that Stella just made is a line of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel's, who said, God is greater than religion. It's a very simple idea. It's a basic idea. God is greater than religion. Greater, Rabbi Heschel would have said, than Jewish religion, greater than Catholic religion, greater than Hindu religion. If God is greater than religion, no religion can claim to own God. The other thing I want to just quickly lift up is concretely and immediately what this means, and Stella's right to draw attention to the human body. In war, it's the human body that suffers, not a human abstraction, not a myth, not a symbol. It's the human body. Last week at the United Nations, there were hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians together in a demonstration where they laid out more than 1,000 coffins representing all of the people who have been killed in this intifada. These people, Israelis and Palestinians, are the parents of children who've been killed in this war in the last 18 months. And what they were reminding us is every casualty in this war is someone's child with a name, a family, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters. If we could think of it that way, we would not pursue a course of war. It's absolutely clear.
James Carroll, our time is running so short, we've just got a minute left. Are we sliding, willy-nilly, like it or not, into a religious war?
It's the danger. When President Bush inadvertently used the word crusade early in this process.
But it was dismissed. We didn't mean it.
Yes,
and he went out of his way to embrace Muslims.
The revelation was it was inadvertent. It was a word that touches the deep, deep movements in the psyche. And in the Western psyche, the impulse to define ourselves over against the other, whether it's Jews or Muslims, is powerful. And we feel licensed by God to do it. When we pray, God bless America, we really should ask the question, what are we saying and what are we attempting to claim about God? God is the creator of the entire human family, and we must honor that God by respecting the human family with an end to war. An end to war, simply, an end to war.
James Carroll, thank you for being with us tonight. James Carroll is author of Constantine's Sword. Listeners, we want to hear your comments. You can email us at onpoint@wbur.org. Or you can send a letter to On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point from WBUR, Boston. This is WBUR.